Jessie closed her eyes tightly. 6 years ago, she had spent an abortive 4-month period in counseling, not telling Gerald because she knew he would be sarcastic, and probably worried about what beans she might be spilling. She had stated her problem as stress, and Nora Callaghan, her therapist, had taught her a simple relaxation technique. Most people associate counting to 10 with Donald Duck trying to keep his temper, Nora had said. But what a 10 count really does is to give you a chance to reset all your emotional dials. And anybody who doesn't need an emotional reset at least once a day has probably got problems a lot more serious than yours or mine. This voice was also clear, clear enough to raise a small, wistful smile on her face. I liked Nora. I liked her a lot. Had she, Jessie, known that at the time? She was moderately astounded to find she couldn't exactly remember, any more than she could exactly remember why she had quit going to see Nora on Tuesday afternoons. She supposed that a bunch of stuff, community chest, the Court Street homeless shelter, maybe the new library fund drive, had just come up all at once. Shit happens, as another piece of New Age vapidity passing for wisdom pointed out. Quitting had probably been for the best, anyway. If you didn't draw the line somewhere, therapy just went on until you and your therapist dotted off to that great group encounter session in the sky together. Never mind, go ahead and do the count, starting with your toes. Do it just the way she taught you. Yes, why not? One is for feet, 10 little toes, cute little piggies all in a row. Except that 8 were comically croggled, and her great toes looked like the heads on a pair of ball-peen hammers. 2 is for legs lovely and long. Well, not that long. She was only 5'6", after all. But Gerald had claimed they were still her best feature, at least in the old sex appeal department. She had always been amused by this claim, which seemed to be perfectly sincere on his part. He had somehow missed her knees, which were as ugly as the knobs on an apple tree, and her chubby upper thighs. 3 is my sex. What's right can't be wrong. Mildly cute. A little too cute, many might say, but not very illuminating. She raised her head a little as if to look at the object in question, but her eyes remained closed. She didn't need her eyes to see it anyway. She had been coexisting with that particular accessory for a long time. What lay between her hips was a triangle of ginger-colored, crinkly hair surrounded by an unassuming slit, with all the aesthetic beauty of a badly healed scar. This thing, this organ that was really little more than a deep fold of flesh cradled by crisscrossing belts of muscle, seemed to her an unlikely wellspring from myth, but it certainly held mythic status in the collective male mind. It was the magic veil, wasn't it? The corral where even the wildest unicorns were eventually penned. Mother McCree, what bullshit, she said, smiling a little but not opening her eyes. Except it wasn't bullshit, not entirely. That slit was the object of every man's lust, the heterosexual ones at least. But it was also frequently an object of their inexplicable scorn, distrust, and hate. You didn't hear that dark anger in all their jokes, but it was present in enough of them, and in some it was right out front, raw as a sore. What's a woman? A life support system for a cunt. Stop it, Jessie, Goodwife Burlingame ordered. Her voice was upset and disgusted. Stop it right now. That, Jessie decided, was a damned good idea, and she turned her mind back to Nora's 10 count. 4 was for her hips, too wide, and 5 her belly, too thick. 6 was her breasts, which she thought were her best feature. Gerald, she suspected, was a bit put off by the vague tracings of blue veins beneath their smoothly sloping curves. The breasts of the gatefold girls in his magazines did not show such hints of the plumbing beneath. The magazine girls didn't have tiny hairs growing out of their areoli, either. 7 was her 2 wide shoulders. 8 was her neck, which used to be good-looking but had grown decidedly chickeny in the last few years. 9 was her receding chin, and 10... Wait a minute! Wait just one goddamn minute here! The no-bullshit voice broke in furiously. What kind of dumb game is this? Jessie shut her eyes tighter, appalled by the depth of anger in that voice and frightened by its separateness. In its anger, it didn't seem like a voice coming from the central taproot of her mind at all, but like a real interloper, a an alien spirit that wanted to possess her the way the spirit of Panzuzu had possessed the little girl in The Exorcist. Don't want to answer that? Ruth Neary, alias Panzuzu, asked. Okay, maybe that one's too complicated. Let me make it really simple for you, Jess. Who turned Nora Callaghan's simple little relaxation litany into a mantra of self-hatred? No one, she thought back meekly, and knew at once that the no-bullshit voice would never accept that. So she added, The good wife, it was her. No, it wasn't. Ruth's voice returned at once. She sounded disgusted at this half-assed effort to shift the blame. Goody's a little stupid, and right now she's a lot scared, but she's a sweet enough thing at the bottom, and her intentions have always been good. The intentions of whoever re-edited Nora's list were actively evil. Jesse, don't you see that? Don't you... I don't see anything because my eyes are closed, she said in a trembling, childish voice. She almost opened them, but something told her that was apt to make the situation worse instead of better. Who was the one, Jesse? Who taught you that you were ugly and worthless? Who picked out Gerald Burlingame as your soulmate and Prince Charming, probably years before you actually met him at that Republican Party mixer? Who decided he wasn't only what you needed, but exactly what you deserved? With a tremendous effort, Jessie swept this voice, all the voices she fervently hoped, out of her mind. She began the mantra again, this time speaking it aloud. One is my toes, all in a row. Two is my legs, lovely and long. Three is my sex, what's right can't be wrong. Four is my hips, curving and sweet. Five is my stomach, where I store what I eat. She couldn't remember the rest of the rhymes, which was probably a mercy. She had a strong suspicion that Nora had wamped them up herself, probably with an eye toward publication in one of the soft and yearning self-help magazines which sat on the coffee table in her waiting room, and so went on without them. Six is my breasts. Seven's my shoulders. Eight's my neck. She paused to take a breath and was relieved to find her heartbeat had slowed from a gallop to a fast run. Nine is my chin, and 10 is my eyes. Eyes open wide. She suited the action to the words, and the bedroom jumped into bright existence around her, somehow new, and for the moment at least, almost as delightful as it had been to her when she and Gerald had spent their first summer in this house. Back in 1979, a year which once had the ring of science fiction and now seemed impossibly antique. Jessie looked at the gray barnboard walls, the high white ceiling with its reflected shimmers from the lake, and the two big windows, one on either side of the bed. The one to her left looked west, giving a view of the deck, the sloping land beyond it, and the heartbreaking bright blue of the lake. The one on her right provided a less romantic vista, the driveway in her gray dowager of a Mercedes, now 8 years old and beginning to show the first small speckles of rust along the rocker panels. Directly across the room, she saw the framed batik butterfly hanging on the wall over the dresser, and remembered with a superstitious lack of surprise that it had been a 30th birthday present from Ruth. She couldn't see the tiny signature stitched in red thread from over here, but she knew it was there. Neary, 83. Another science fiction year. Not far from the butterfly, and clashing like mad, although she had never quite summoned enough nerve to point this out to her husband, Gerald's Alpha Gamma Rho Bierstein hung from a chrome peg. Rho wasn't a very bright star in the fraternity universe. The other frat rats used to call it Alpha Grabaho, but Gerald wore that pin with a perverse sort of pride, and kept the stein on the wall and drank the first beer of the summer out of it each year when they came down here in June. It was the sort of ceremony that had sometimes made her wonder, long before today's festivities, if she had been mentally competent when she married Gerald. Somebody should have put a stop to it, she thought drearily. Somebody really should have, because just look how it turned out. In the chair on the other side of the bathroom door, she could see the saucy little culotte skirt and the sleeveless blouse she had worn down on this unseasonably warm fall day. Her bra hung on the bathroom doorknob, and lying across the bedspread in her legs, turning the tiny soft hairs on her upper thighs to golden wires, was a bright band of afternoon sunlight. not the square of light that lay almost dead center on the bedspread at 1 o'clock, and not the rectangle which lay on it at 2. This was a wide band that would soon narrow to a stripe, and although a power outage had buggered the readout of the digital clock radio on the dresser, it flashed 12 a.m. over and over, as relentless as a neon bar sign. The band of light told her it was going on 4 o'clock. Before long, the stripe would start to slide off the bed, and she would see shadows in the corners and under the little reading table over by the wall. And as the stripe became a string, first slipping across the floor and then climbing up the far wall, fading as it went, those shadows would begin to creep out of their places and spread across the room like ink stains, eating the light as they grew. The sun was westering. In another hour, an hour and a half at most, it would be going down. 40 minutes or so after that, it would be dark. This thought didn't cause panic, at least not yet, but it did lay a membrane of gloom over her mind and a dank atmosphere of dread over her heart. She saw herself lying here, handcuffed to the bed with Gerald dead on the floor beside and below her. Saw them lying here in the dark long after the man with a chainsaw had gone back to his wife and kids and well-lighted home. And the dog had wandered away, and there was only that damned loon out there on the lake for company. Only that, and nothing more. Mr. and Mrs. Gerald Burlingame, spending one last long night together. Looking at the beer stein and the batik butterfly, unlikely neighbors which could only be tolerated in a one-season-a-year house such as this one. Jessie thought that it was easy to think about the past, and just as easy, although a lot less pleasant, to go wandering off into possible versions of the future. The really tough job seemed to be staying in the present, but she thought she'd better try her best to do it. This nasty situation was probably going to get a lot nastier if she didn't. She couldn't depend on some deus ex machina to help her get out of the jam she was in. And that was a bummer. But if she succeeded in doing it herself, there would be a bonus. She'd be saved the embarrassment of lying here almost starkers while some sheriff's deputy unlocked her, asked what the hell had happened, and got a nice long look at the new widow's fair white body, all at the same time. There were two other things going on as well. She would have given a lot to push them away, even temporarily, but she couldn't. She needed to go to the bathroom, and she was thirsty. Right now, the need to ship was stronger than the need to receive, but it was her desire for a drink of water that worried her. It wasn't a big deal yet, but that would change if she wasn't able to shuck the cuffs and get to a faucet. It would change in ways she didn't like to think of. It'd be funny if I died of thirst 200 yards from the 9th biggest lake in Maine, she thought. And then she shook her head. This wasn't the 9th biggest lake in Maine. What had she been thinking of? That was Dark Score Lake, the one where she and her parents and her brother and sister had gone all those years ago, back before the voices, back before... She cut that off, hard. It had been a long time since she'd thought about Dark Score Lake, and she didn't intend to start now, handcuffs or no handcuffs. Better to think about being thirsty. What's to think about, Toots? It's psychosomatic, that's all. You're thirsty because you know you can't get up and get a drink. It's as simple as that. But it wasn't. She'd had a fight with her husband, and the two swift kicks she'd dealt him had started a chain reaction which finally resulted in his death. She herself was suffering the after effects of a major hormone spill. The technical term for it was shock, and one of the commonest symptoms of shock was thirst. She should probably count herself lucky that her mouth was no drier than it was, at least so far, and... And maybe that's the one thing I can do something about. Gerald was the quintessential creature of habit, and one of his habits was keeping a glass of water on his side of the shelf above the headboard of the bed. She twisted her head up and to the right, and yes, there it was, a tall glass of water with a little cluster of melting ice cubes floating on top. The glass was no doubt sitting on a coaster so it wouldn't leave a ring on the shelf. That was Gerald. So considerate about the little things. Beads of condensation stood out on the glass like sweat. Looking at these, Jessie felt her first pang of real thirst. It made her lick her lips. She slid to the right as far as the chain on the left handcuff would allow. This was only 6 inches, but it brought her onto Gerald's side of the bed. The movement also exposed several dark spots on the left side of the coverlet. She stared at these vacantly for several moments before remembering how Gerald had voided his bladder in his last agony. Then she quickly turned her eyes back to the glass of water, sitting up there on a round of cardboard which probably advertised some brand of yuppie suds, Beck's or Heineken being the most likely. She reached out and up, doing it slowly, willing her reach to be long enough. It wasn't. The tips of her fingers stopped 3 inches short of the glass. The pang of thirst, a slight tightening in the throat, a slight prickle on the tongue, came and went again. If no one comes or I can't think of a way to wiggle free by tomorrow morning, I won't even be able to look at that glass. This idea had about it a cold reasonableness that was terrifying in and of itself. But she wouldn't still be here tomorrow morning, that was the thing. The idea was totally ridiculous. Insane, as a matter of fact. Loopy. Not worth thinking about. It... Stop, the no-bullshit voice said. Just stop. And so she did. The thing she had to face was that the idea wasn't totally ridiculous. She refused to accept or even entertain the possibility that she could die here. That was Loopy, of course. But she could be in for some long, uncomfortable hours if she didn't dust away the cobwebs on the old thinking machine and get it running. Long, uncomfortable, and maybe painful, the good wife said nervously. But the pain would be an act of atonement, wouldn't it? After all, you brought this on yourself. I hope I'm not being tiresome, but if you just let him shoot his squirt... You are being tiresome, Goody, Jessie said. She couldn't remember if she had ever spoken out loud to one of the interior voices before. She wondered if she was going mad. She decided she didn't give much of a shit one way or another, at least for the time being. Jessie closed her eyes again.